Wild Missions original podcast.
Borneo is a treasure trove of biodiversity, with over 220 species of mammals, 420 species of birds, and 15,000 species of plants. It's also home to the palm oil industry, responsible for at least 39% of forest loss in Borneo between 2000 and 2018. But what you might not know is that deforestation greatly increases the risk of disease transmission. Suddenly, this precious and fragile forest ecosystem is ripped wide open, and you have people, wildlife, and domestic animals all interacting with each other. This is a significant threat to the endangered wildcat species of Borneo, as they share these palm oil plantations not only with each other, but also domestic cats that could be carrying one of the many deadly feline viruses, such as feline coronavirus and feline panleukopenia. So in this episode, we'll meet the researchers studying these viral pathways in the palm oil plantations of Malaysian Borneo, and explore disease transmission, their results so far, and what we need to do in the future to keep wildcats, people, and pets safe. I'm Andy Varvel, and this is Cats of the Wild, episode 25, Cats on the Edge. I'd like you to meet Sergio.
My name is Sergio Guerrero. I was born and lived in Mexico for almost half of my life.
He's a postdoctoral researcher at City University in Hong Kong.
I moved to the south of Mexico to work in a zoo in Chiapas, just in the border with Guatemala. And I worked there for 10 years, and I did some research and collaborations with wildlife also in Mexico. The work just drive me to look more into understanding how diseases are shared or transmitted between different species in the wild and what is the consequences of fragmentation. So I realized that I need to learn more on ecology and then mix both experiences, the ecology and the veterinarian expertise, to have some more answers.
Sergio was finishing his master's thesis in Mexico when he got a call from a friend in Borneo working at a research center. They were looking for a wildlife veterinarian to assist with some research projects for a few months.
In my mind, was like 3 months is not enough, you know, traveling to the other side of the world, to this mythic island of Borneo. For many in Mexico and probably in other parts, like the name of Borneo is an icon of the big jungle, dense jungle, right? When you were a kid, you heard Borneo and the first thing that comes to your mind is King Kong.
He's always been king of his world, but we'll teach him fear. We're millionaires, boys. I'll share it with all of you. Why, in a few months, it'll be up in lights on Broadway. Kong, the eighth wonder of the world!
I say, okay, I go for 3 months, but I really want to stay longer.
Sergio ended up staying in Borneo for 10 years, and it's there he met Liz, the co-author of this research paper.
Hi, my name is Lisbeth Frias.
She's a parasitologist.
And I'm a postdoctoral researcher at the Nanyang Technological University here in Singapore.
As a kid, Liz was fascinated with ancient Egypt.
I was obsessed with Egyptian mummies, as many kids are. But what I was focused on was how people had died. So I was very interested in that, like why they became mummies, like how did that happen? And in my head, it was just very interesting that these microscopic organisms were capable of, you know, taking down pharaohs and emperors everywhere. But then that interest started to shift a little bit. And I would say it became bigger because eventually I realized that parasites are even more amazing than I thought they were. They're a big component of biodiversity. They have a lot of very important roles in ecosystems. So they turn out to be quite amazing by themselves.
Now, when I think of parasites, my mind goes straight to those super deadly parasites that eat people's brains through their nose or things like that. But there's plenty of examples of how parasites are absolutely essential for global biodiversity.
So one key example on how they, for example, can regulate populations. It's kind of a textbook example on the red grouse and its parasitic worm. So this grouse is infected by a parasite that is shed in feces. And then when the grouse population increases too much in terms of density of individuals, then you have more parasites accumulated in the environment. So that becomes detrimental to the host and the grouse start to die. But that helps like the greater good because that avoids that the population depletes their own local resources. And then eventually the population recuperates and can go back to normal numbers. So that's kind of a cyclic population regulation that parasites do on this. That's one example. But there are many. Many parasites are able to, for example, capture heavy metals and other harmful pollutants in the environment, which can protect the host in a way. And it has been observed that they can actually do that many times more than the host would do. So for example, in some shark species, it has been found that certain cestodes are able to capture 10 times more pollutants than the shark could by its own.
Lisbeth is from Chile, and she did her master's in Brazil before heading to Japan to study wildlife parasites.
So my PhD was on primate parasites. So the idea was to go to Borneo. And in Sabah, the Kinabatangan area is a very rich place in terms of wildlife in general, but particularly for primates. So you can find over 10 primate species just in one wildlife sanctuary. So to understand parasite diversity and distribution, it was kind of an interesting scenario. And of course, you have this very fragmented sanctuary that is surrounded by oil palm plantations. That kind of landscapes allows you to ask very interesting questions, which can have very sad answers at times.
Here's Sergio again.
The main interest is to see how these fragmented landscapes have an impact on the wildlife populations, not just in the ecological aspect, but also in the how diseases can be transmitted between species in that edge between wildlife and domestic animals. And Borneo in particular is a very interesting laboratory for that answer because of the high fragmentation that they have, right? So when we met again, we start thinking on this Health at the Edge project. That was the main goal.
Borneo is the largest island in Asia, and it's not actually a country. It's shared amongst three countries, Indonesia in the south, and Malaysia and Brunei to the north. It is home to one of the oldest rainforests in the world, and it has 5 species of wildcat.
All of them are very different in terms of their habitat requirements and where you can find them in Borneo, right? So on the one hand, we have the endangered flat-headed cat, which prefers to live in wetland forests, and it's really hard to see in the fields. But we have heard of some reports on plantations or on plantation borders. So it seems that it is able to some extent to use anthropogenic areas. We also have the Sunda toilet leopard, which is probably the most charismatic. It's the largest of the cats in Borneo. Also prefers forests, but again, because most of the forest has been fragmented, it's kind of forced to go through plantations at times, or to go from one patch to another has to cross part of the plantations. Then we have the most enigmatic cats, cryptic cats, the bay cat on the one hand, and the marble cats. Those are forest specialists. And because they are small cat and they prefer living in the forest, it's really hard to study them and learn about them. And of course, one of the cats, possibly the only generalist cat among this group, is the leopard cat. It seems to be, within the cat group, it seems to be the most well adapted to plantation areas. It's not that hard to see them roam in the plantations and in the forest. So we thought it could be an interesting model to understand processes of pathogen transmission at the border.
This research was part of the Health at the Edge project, supported by the Panthera Small Cat Action Fund. And they focus on disease transmission at this edge or interface. It's the areas like palm oil plantations, where humans and their domestic animals can mix with wildlife. In Sabah, a Malaysian state in the north of Borneo, 20% of all land is palm oil plantation. So this edge isn't exactly small or insignificant. It's all over the island.
When I got there for the first time, we drove there from the sea. And if you drive there, you get to see a lot of things that you were not expecting to see. So plantations everywhere. And for me, perhaps the most impactful thing was at some point we made a stop along the highway. And you could see plantations everywhere, like everywhere. Not a single big tree. And that for me was very impactful. I was wondering, where's the forest? Where am I supposed to study? And I guess that's first impressions. Then I guess you can go either of two ways. You can just hate that things are like that and hate plantations, or you can just accept that that's what we have right now.
The first impression is shocking, and you can get mad at that. But when you get to live there and get more involved in the dynamics of the state or the place, you understand many, many things, and you learn that you don't have to fight against old bands or the people that is encroaching the forest. No, you don't have to fight them. You have to work with them. You have to find a way to work with them.
There are many reasons why plantations are here, historical, sociopolitical, many, many reasons. And you might choose to work in that framework, to do something about what we have now.
You have to find a way to work with them. So, yeah, that's a shocking experience, but that's also, for me, was a very important lesson.
Since COVID-19, there's been a lot more talk and focus on wildlife disease transmission. A single disease transmitted from one species to another can have a devastating impact. For example, in 1994, canine distemper virus, a common serious disease affecting dogs, spread to the lion population in Serengeti Reserve in Tanzania, where approximately one-third or 1,000 lions died due to the virus.
People are talking more about infectious diseases, for sure. But it's still difficult in some cases, and especially when you don't have this baseline data, to convince on the importance of studying this. So for example, in Borneo, and not only in Borneo, we know in general that domestic cats and wild cats, you know, are close relatives, so they are able to share pathogens, not a crazy idea. And we know that we have cats in plantations and we have wild cats in the forest. So all the elements are there. But because we didn't have any previous information that said that this was an important problem to pursue, it's really hard to say or to highlight the significance of the study.
So Sergio, Liz, and their research team sought out to get blood samples from wildcats in and around these plantation areas between 2019 and 2021, as well as domestic cats, with the permission and assistance of their owners. They caught two Sunda clouded leopards via cage traps, as well as five leopard cats and two flat-headed cats with nets. Cats were anaesthetized, health and body condition assessed, and then a blood sample was taken before they were safely returned to the wild.
They roam in the plantation. So especially leopard cats seem to be a bit more familiar with people. So not necessarily that they get too close, but close enough to get spotted. And then thanks to the experience of the research assistants that we were working with, so we were able to catch them, right? Flat-headed cats are probably more difficult because they are much more difficult to see and probably less abundant also. So fortunately, the ones that we got were not the main target, but was a good opportunity to sample these cats too. For netting, you need to walk long distances and see if you can see the cat. I will say that this more secure that if you see the cat and your team is very well built, then you will get it. But still, to be very patient. You can walk for long distances for weeks and you don't see any cat.
Once they had the blood samples, they sent these off for processing to test against four common feline diseases: feline panleukopenia, feline calici virus, feline herpivirus, and feline coronavirus. And to be clear, that's a different type of coronavirus to COVID-19. All four viruses were present amongst their sample of 27 domestic cats. And in the wild cats, all but feline herpivirus were found.
The coronavirus and the panleukopenia are the most concerned viruses. All of them are very well known in domestic animals. They have vaccinations and they have a good program prevention in urban areas, right? But in rural areas, it's not well known for the people how to prevent this kind of diseases. So it's very common to have cats that they are not vaccinated in rural areas. Especially from the coronavirus and the panleukopenia are a bit more concerned because they can harm the cats very badly. They can drive them to death, especially for kittens. It's more problematic. But the major concern is that these viruses are persistent in environment for weeks or even months. So when you are in this kind of habitats where territories from domestic and wild cats overlap, they don't need to fight each other. They don't need to have physical encounters. But as long as one tick cat is walking in the territory and then a few days later, a wild cat is walking around and sniffing the urine or the feces from the domestic cat that has been sick, transmission can occur. We know that these diseases are very bad for domestic cats, especially for kittens. So we can assume that they can be also very bad for wild cats. We cannot prove that easily in tropic areas because in the jungle it's very difficult to see a cat. And when they get sick, you don't see that so easy. So it's just an assumption. But we have the experience also from that has been learned from Africa and the distemper virus in lions, for example, or cheetahs, right? So we know these viruses can harm populations. So that's the concern.
It's not clear in what direction disease is being transmitted between wildcats and domestic cats. But for Liz and Sergio, that's not really important right now.
As the diseases can be transmitted in both directions, the concern is that makes the disease more prevalent in the area. And the more prevalent, the more risk for both the domestic and the wild species. That should be probably the main focus.
It's more to know what's out there and having a baseline that we can use for future monitoring. I think that this paper puts out important information in that sense because it gives you a reference data to what's happening now and what will be happening in, say, 3 years, 5 years.
So what does the future look like for the wild cats in Borneo? How can we protect these endangered species from viruses present in domestic animals, such as plantation owners' cats?
Plantations are not going to disappear anytime soon. So I think if we can show that having a management program within plantations for domestic animals, it's possible that it has a good outcome both for domestic animals and for the health of wild populations, then we can help a little bit to mitigate pathogen transmission in interface areas. So when we started working with plantation states, we did some surveys and talked to people, and none of the cats that we examined had been vaccinated, nurtured, or dewormed at all. So these are animals that arrive to plantations with their owners when the workers start living within the plantation quarters. So it's really important to support these vaccination, nurturing, deworming campaigns to help manage the population of domestic animals, especially in areas that are in proximity to the forest border.
I think that what is needed to do is to work together between plantations, academia, government, to design protocols for prevention and monitoring of diseases, right? This is the main thing. One important thing that everyone is agreed that has to be done is the control of domestic populations in rural areas to minimize the overabundance of domestic cats, for example, especially feral cats, feral dogs, right? And the only way to do that is population control in those areas. That, along with well-designed vaccination programs for the domestic animals, will help to mitigate the impact of these diseases in the wild. But also, at the same time, that helps to the welfare of the domestic cats, which are also important for the community. Right? They are the pest control for the houses. They are good companions for some of them. They have cultural value. So we also have to take care of them at the same time. And so looking for integrative approach to control the population and the diseases, it's something that has to be done. And it's possible. It's possible. Just need to sit down with all the stakeholders and talk.
It's so fantastic that this research has now established a baseline in what disease transmission looks like between wild cats and domestic cats. It's the springboard for future research, funding, and community programs. Now, it's easy and naive to think that these palm oil plantation communities are responsible for destroying these beautiful old forests. But in reality, the issue is so much larger and complex than any one community. The people in these communities want to protect these forests, and they want to look after their families and their pets, like we all do.
It's very nice to see the willingness of people and how the local community and the villagers look at their own cats, right? They have names, they have, it's not a surprise. You can see it everywhere, but living that experience, it gives you a very nice feeling. They are willing to collaborate with us also. They know that we are what we are doing, and the willingness to collaborate is also a very important part of the job. Most of the time, you don't need to say anything. They know that it's important. I mean, they know that it's important for their cats, and they know that it's important for them. They are concerned. And this is something that sometimes we don't, as conservationists, as wildlife researchers, we forget and we don't realize that they are concerned. They know that it's important. They know that they have to protect the forest. They have to protect their own animals too. Sometimes it's just find a way how to work together.
Hi, my name is Lisbeth Frias, and if you want to learn more about the Health at the Edge project, you can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.
Thank you so much to Liz and Sergio for their time. Their research was supported by the Danau Gerang Field Centre, Panthera through its Small Cat Action Fund, University of Malaysia Sabah, Ocean Park Conservation Foundation, Sime Darby Foundation, Houston Zoo, and Nanyang Technological University. Cats of the Wild is created by me, Andy Marvel. Theme music is by Score Squad. Other music and sound effects from Envato.